Hello and welcome to another episode of Balanced Body Radio. I'm your host, Casey Ruff, and today we have another amazing guest to introduce to you now. Dr. Stefan Zavalin is a doctor of physical therapy focused on providing an approach to improve the well-being of individuals and organizations. Over the years, it has become obvious to Dr. Zavalin that a majority of patients seen in the clinic suffer from chronic factors due to reduced movement, improper stress management, and limited exposure to natural environments. Those issues can lead to pain, immune suppression, and reduced happiness. He created the Love to Move, Move to Love concept, which provides virtual consulting for work environment design and physical wellness in the workplace through presentations and individual sessions. With research-based consultations, he can analyze and provide opportunities to improve mental, physical, and emotional wellness and quality of work life. Dr. Stefan Zavalin, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Boundless Body Radio.
Oh, I am beyond thrilled to be on. I've been excited about this. Definitely the highlight of my week.
That's awesome, man. We're so excited to have you on, too. We've been looking forward to this as well. You're based out of Nashville, is that correct?
That's correct. So you're a couple hours ahead of me.
Yeah, that's right.
Over in Utah, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. How in the world did Nashville become a hockey city?
I don't know. And it's I love that we put our own twist on it. From the whole idea of throwing salmon onto the ice, then we decided we're not really a salmon city. Let's do catfish instead. And so people started throwing catfish on the ice. And I just thought, well, at least you guys made it Nashville-esque. I'm originally from Russia, so I was kind of going, yeah, hockey, why not? It makes sense. It's kind of hot here, but it makes sense.
Wow, that's amazing. So I've heard, like, if you go watch a game like up in Toronto or Montreal, like, you're going to watch it with people who, like, really, really understand every nuance of the game, and it's really fun. But if you go to Nashville, it's just a ruckus party, and it sure looks like that. It looks like a blast.
So this is also partially because of where the arena is located. It is located right on Broadway, which is the place to go if you're trying to go to all the bars and do crazy partying. So inevitably that culture is gonna sort of seep into the arena and into the people to a large degree. We've now become the bachelorette capital, I believe. And that's, so there are a lot of bachelorette parties and there's all this craziness. And wow. I think that's what's kind of affected it as well. And of course, most people are not out here playing hockey. So they kind of go, well, we may not know the game, but we know how to party.
That's amazing. I think I'd rather watch a game there than in Toronto. Although both would be amazing. Like, it looks like a lot of fun. I want to deep dive into your personal story and how you got interested in movement, especially in the workplace. I think it's so relevant during a pandemic, obviously. But before we dive into that, I want to talk about your experience getting your doctorate and an interesting challenge you faced. I'm really curious about how did you power through getting your doctorate with the condition that you had?
Yeah, so that was a whole interesting thing of where... So. The reason that I chose the grad school that I went to, which is Arcadia University, no big secret, is it just felt very, very homey to me. And this plays an important role because all the professors and everybody, it's like a big family, and that definitely helped with all of it. But that was the main reason that I kind of chose to go there. And so the semester started as one would expect. I was all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed going, I'm in PT school. This is amazing. I'm going to go change the world, as grad students tend to be. And started off great. I'm enthused with everything. And I've kind of had a little bit of a vision issue from birth. One of my optic nerves of my right eye, it didn't fully develop. So half of it is just dead. And that eye is kind of useless for all intents and purposes. Nothing's going to help it because it's the nerve. It's not the actual organ of the eye. So we tried when I was little and it never worked. And then later we found out, oh, this is why you can't really do anything. So glasses and everything don't help. So I have my other eye. It works great. I wore contacts. Fantastic. And so at one point I realized, ooh, I'm getting a little bit light sensitive. And the contacts that I wore, they were kind of hard. So getting my eye scratched here or there a couple times a year, it happened. No big deal. Eyes heal really fast. I said, I'll be fine. I'll get over it. And then a week goes by and I'm going, I'm still really light sensitive. It's not going away. It's kind of hurting. So I decided, I'm going to go to the doctor. Go to the doctor. They go, oh, you look like you might have a bacterial infection. You look like you have a little scrape on your eye, probably from the lens. No worries. Go, great. Antibiotic. Week later, nothing changed. I go back. I'm like, what's the deal? And they're like, well, we misdiagnosed you. it was actually a virus. I go, oh, okay. They're like, it's no problem. Very common virus. It's basically like a cold sore on your eye, effectively. And so they, here's another medication. You'll be fine. Wow. Several weeks down the road of that, I go, okay, guys, it's not getting better. So what is it? They're like, oh, it's okay. And at this point, I'm like in the classroom. It's a darkened classroom overall, but I'm sitting there in sunglasses, looking at the screen, barely able to look at it. That's how light sensitive I am.
Wow.
It's hard for me to drive. I'm having my friends kind of try to drive me places and pick me up, my classmates, because this is up in Philadelphia. So it's not like I'm around home to where I know people. It's just my classmates, which brings in that family component of where everybody was very close knit and wonderful. And then they say, well, let's just dump a bunch of steroids in there. We'll just up your steroid dose and you can just decrease the inflammation, which may be a metaphor for our entire medical system to some degree. But that's essentially what they did. And I was going, hey, I feel better. This feels great. I'm getting back to my own life. And this is where we're getting, remember, this is first semester, to that point of around Christmas time. And so I head back home for Christmas and the holidays. I see yet another couple of doctors here. All of them say, yep, virus, very common, no worries. The problematic thing that they kept saying is, it gets better in a couple weeks. And I'm like, it's been a couple months. What's not lining up here? I don't understand. But things felt relatively okay because I was just dumping the steroid in over and over and over. And then finally in January, it had had enough and the steroids were not helping. And I was completely basically in misery. And it was a specific day. My dad found some doctor up in Philadelphia because I'd returned back there. And they were a big clinic and I had a classmate drive me. And I specifically remember it because it had snowed. So classes were canceled, but it didn't snow so bad that we couldn't drive. It was one of those beautiful days of where you could still go out and do it. So basically got a day off school. And I spent it at a doctor's office. I think, and props to this guy, I probably send him a little message at least once a year, just be like, hey, thank you for that one time that you drove me over there. Because he sat at the doctor's office with me for about like 6 hours.
Wow.
And at this point, he knew me for what, 3-4 months maybe?
Wow.
And they basically said, hey, this is not a virus. This is a parasite that commonly presents like this virus. And I got it for tap water. Usually our tears kill it, but because I had the contact that covered the cut, the tears couldn't get to it. And so it healed over by the time I took my contact out. And so then we were doing all this other stuff and it wasn't helping. And the steroids just allowed it to grow and grow and grow and just multiply. And that started just this huge cascade. So that was the point where they said, listen, we know you're in school, but this is not going away in a week or two. This is a hard one. And I was like, oh, okay, well, let's see. I didn't know what I was in for, but it ended up going through, to make a long story short, about 5 different surgeries. I had to put diluted bleach effectively into my eye to try to kill off the parasite.
What?
And this medication, so it's diluted bleach every hour. And there were 3 different medications of it. And when I say every hour, I do mean every single hour, 24 hours.
What? Sleep?
And you just had, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You just had Kevin on, who was talking about the importance of sleep a little while back. And so the most I could get was 45 minutes because the drops needed to be spaced 5 minutes apart. So I needed 15 minutes for the drops. And I would wake up and I had alarms every hour throughout the night for about a month and a half. Oh. That day when the doctor said, you know, at night, you can now go to 2 hours. I just cried in the office. I was like, you don't understand. I'm so happy I can sleep. So needless to say, I took the rest of that year and everything off of school and finally came back and joined in with the class below us, which was great because my friends became my TAs and that was all wonderful. I wasn't as intimidated by them. I knew them all very well. But it eventually with all of the surgeries and everything, even though my vision returned for about a year or so, there started to be more nerve damage. And how interestingly it happened, all of this was happening in my one good eye. I should have probably mentioned at the beginning, but the nerve got damaged in that eye as well, which then basically rendered me legally blind.
Wow.
But I was able to finish off the school and everything like that, which was beautiful because a lot of physical therapy is manual therapy, and that's what I focused on as well. And that's more hands-on. So in a lot of ways, I didn't have to rely on my eyes, and that made it easier and even better for me. Wow. In some respects.
That's crazy.
So that was a crazy, fun story. Yeah.
Wow. So you really, really, really wanted that doctorate to go through all of that and want to go back to school to get that. That's crazy. What a story.
Yeah.
Wow. I understand you got into movement after doing a music major. Were you a fellow bass player, I believe?
Yes, I was. Nice. Actually, the story of all that is also very interesting because it's life sometimes happens in cycles, and we only realize when we get to the next part. When I was in sixth grade, I decided to join orchestra because I no longer wanted to be in gym, of all things. And if you played in the orchestra, you didn't have to go to gym. I just thought gym was very boring. I liked sports, but I hated our gym class. And so then I got into music, and I wanted to play the violin initially, but they needed a bass player. So I played bass. And then I loved it. And all through high school, it deteriorated for me. I played more music, and I moved less and exercised less, and I got overweight. And there was a whole cascade of things of kind of that shame. You're going through high school with all the teenagers and puberty and all that stuff. And so I said, who needs all that? I'm just going to be a bass player and a musician. I don't have to work out and do anything like that. And then slowly but surely around senior year, my parents were really pushing on me to try to get into shape. And that's kind of what started me finding out about working out at the gym and all these kinds of things besides just playing sports and how I need to support my health and well-being. Definitely made many mistakes. I think many of us do because I didn't know where to go for guidance, but eventually that's what pushed me further and further and had it on my mind when I was in undergrad to go, okay, I'm going to get a kinesiology degree. What do I do with that? Oh, PT school. And there you go. Slowly but surely made my way there.
Gotcha. What is physical therapy school like?
So it's a job. I am honestly impressed with people that can work a full-time job and go to PT school because we had lectures 9 to 5. Sometimes it was 8 to 4, but truly we had lectures just all the way through. It was full block schedules and it was lectures and some lab, but you're in it. You live physical therapy. Everything you're thinking about is physical therapy. And it's very interesting because you'll try to talk to other people and you understand you're not talking the same language while you're in PT school. Your thoughts are completely different. You're looking at people and they're like, why are you watching that person walk? And I'm like, that cane isn't adjusted properly. I can tell. And they're like, really? That's what you're looking at? And I'm like, that's all we think about, all we talk about. And every single thing that you do, you go to the gym as, so we had a very small gym at the university because in general, it's a very small school and all the PT kids are in the gym and barely anybody else is. And because we all know how important it is. So it's very, very close knit. And interestingly enough, more women than men, it's usually about a 2-to-1 ratio. But because it's small, our class was actually very big with 60 people. But usually they're small classes. So you get to know each other very, very well. And you're constantly talking about biomechanics, exercise science, and all those kinds of things. So PT school, it's great if you want to nerd out, but it is essentially a job.
Gotcha. It sounds pretty involved. What kinds of techniques do you end up learning? Like what are some of the more important things that you do with people when you see them?
Sure. And this is the interesting thing of why I love the school that I went to. So our school prepared us to be good physical therapists. There are some schools that prepare you to pass the boards, which it's kind of almost a catch-22. You can't be a physical therapist unless you pass the boards, but passing the boards literally means learning from a textbook and just answering multiple choice questions from a textbook, which that doesn't make you a good physical therapist. There's some argument that might make you a very good doctor because of the amount of decision-making that they need to do. It's a good model for that. But for a physical therapist who really has to have hands-on doing manual techniques and things like that, this is what the school concentrated on more. At the end, they actually told us, they're like, we didn't train you for the boards. So now you have to go study for the boards separately.
Oh, wow.
Which made us go, what did we pay for? but when the beauty was that once we got out into the clinics, we went, oh, we're steps ahead of other students because they've trained us to be physical therapists as opposed to passing, just passing the boards. And I'm not saying all schools do that. Usually there's a combination, but it's just, this is what this school was centered around. And you learned a lot of different techniques, but what they focused on is a lot of manual, which basically means that's your kind of like the massage therapy, the joint mobilizations, kind of if you want to think about what a chiropractor does, except that we don't do the kind of the snap, the manipulation is what they call it. We are legally not allowed to call them manipulations. So there's a way to get around it. And what we call it in the legal is a mobilization. And there's different grades. And the extreme grade of a mobilization is technically what a manipulation is, but we can't call it that. So you learn all of these techniques. And then on top of it, you start learning more intricate things like, okay, so ice versus heat, when are you going to use it? Now, what do you use for heat? Because you could use hot packs, you could use wax and paraffin, where that's great for your hands, where people can put wax around their hands. Obviously, they can't do that at home. You have to have a specific little bath in order to do that. Whether you need to be using just an ice pack or like an ice popsicle is actually what they called it, where you can do a massage with a specific ice popsicle. So taking those in. And then we had a crazy scientist. I like to call him a crazy scientist. There's also the aspect of electrophysiology, which is all of the TENS units and all that kind of stuff. If you've ever seen the little electrodes, a lot of CrossFit athletes nowadays also use them for recovery. Well, they'll put them on. Those are kind of enough, a branch off of all of that. And we talked at length about how much you can use electricity in order to stimulate muscles, stimulate nerves, look for recovery, reducing pain. And the reason that I say that it was a crazy scientist is because he actually in lecture tells us that he's got a couple units at home that he took out resistors from so he could amp up the amount of output on there beyond what the manufacturers intended. So we were like, well, we're not letting you shock us, but we'll practice on ourselves.
Wow.
But those are there. It's very, very interesting. One of the tests that we had to do. So the interesting thing about shocking yourself, if anybody ever thinks about doing it, and so when I say shocking yourself, I mean putting electrodes on and facilitating a muscle contraction, is it's very strange when you see your muscle contract without you actually thinking about contracting it. It feels almost wrong and like it shouldn't be happening. One of our tests was that we had to set up a patient, which was a fellow student, and make their quad contract and basically output 50% of the maximum that they could actually do themselves. But they weren't contracting their muscle. Electricity was contracting their muscle.
Wow.
So we weren't really torquing anything too extreme. It was 50% of what they could actually do. So the forces were perfectly fine. But when you have it done to you and you're not controlling it, it feels like the muscle is just going to tear off of your leg. And it's a very interesting and experience overall.
Wow. Sounds crazy.
But yeah. Wow. So there was those are a slew of things that we learned in PT school.
Interesting. So you mentioned the difference between like a good physical therapist and, you know, I would assume somebody who's not good. I had an experience when I got injured, broke my collarbone and my wrist, you know, back in high school, and I did physical therapy, but it didn't take very many sessions to realize like, maybe this is working, maybe it isn't, but I'm just coming in and doing the same thing this whole time. So I kind of got bored of it. Like I know my insurance paid for like 12 sessions or whatever they paid for, and I kind of had to go, but I didn't feel like it really did that much. In your opinion, what is the difference between a good physical therapist and a not so good physical therapist?
Man, there's so many things to unbox there. I think the one, if I had to name one thing, it would be goal oriented. What I mean by that is, so a patient comes in, so you came in and I would go, what do you want to be able to do? What are your goals for your collarbone and whatever else? What are you trying to get back to? If we are consistently doing the same exact exercise to train just one little muscle, you can do that at home if you're motivated enough. We don't need to progress that. That doesn't necessarily need to change. And this is kind of where a lot of PT gets a bad rep, is where people go in and do three sets of 10 of, say, an older person has difficulty standing up from a chair, and they just put little ankle weights on them and they kick out three sets of 10. well, that's not, yes, you're activating the quad, but you're not asking a person, that's not them standing up. Have them practice squats or anything like that. So finding what the patient actually wants to be able to accomplish and put the exercises around that so that they're achieving and getting closer to the function that they want or the reduced pain that they want or whatever it may be. The other part, and I'm guessing this is maybe what you had, I don't know, is there has to be a combination of hands-on as well as the exercise. Exercises are great and wonderful, but if they're combined with hands-on things like massage or joint mobilization, it's a completely different world with all of that. And I think you even know that from training clients, is if you're able to get your hands even on and correct a client a little bit, even just that tiny amount, is way better if you just verbally tell them, yeah, you're doing it right. Yeah, keep squeezing your shoulder blades or whatever else it might be. So the hands-on approach, I think, sometimes is lacking. When I went to physical therapy at one point, and my physical therapist just kept on, she was on her computer and she would just say, yep, just keep going. Yeah, you're doing that right. And there wasn't really a lot of back and forth. Hmm. So goal-oriented and hands-on.
Wow. What a novel concept, actually asking the person what they want and then listening. That's crazy.
Yeah, right.
It's a very novel concept. We shouldn't even have to talk about that. It's so funny. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure that when you first started, I'll bet you it was pretty quick that you started to notice general patterns. You maybe wouldn't see the same thing over and over, and people had different goals. But I would imagine, you know, taking a 30,000 foot view, you probably saw the same patterns. And I would love to know, like, what kind of patterns you saw more often than not.
Sure. Undoubtedly, the most that I saw is back pain and neck pain. And so I actually started off in a skilled nursing facility. It's a long-term care facility and a skilled nursing facility. For those that don't know, effectively, if you had a knee replacement and there is absolutely no way that you're going to be able to get back into your home or whatever it might be, you go there for your rehabilitation so that we can get you good enough so you can safely go back home. Long-term care facility is basically like a nursing home, if you want to think about that. They also had it. So I was working with a lot of very, very sick people with a lot of different comorbidities. And then I transitioned more into an outpatient setting, which is where everyday people just coming into the clinic, kind of like you were, anything like that. So with that in mind, the everyday, it's neck and back pain over pretty much everything else. Sure, you have your athletes that might have an ACL, or you know, you have your people that have hip pain and sciatica, but so much of sciatica is coming also from the back. And it's just, people just aren't moving. I had one patient the entire time, and the golden patient, he came in and he said, so nothing is wrong with me, but I want to make sure that I will maintain my kind of agility, flexibility, and mobility. Can you please work with me and make sure that I have all the right movements and exercises to be able to support myself and my health? One time, that I never had a patient like that afterwards. most people, you had to almost sell on the fact that, yes, this is what we're going to do. This is what's going to help you. Shoulders are an interesting one as well. Definitely a lot of people have issues with shoulders, and I don't think they paid enough attention to it, because they kind of go, it still works. Maybe it clicks a little bit here or there, but it doesn't necessarily cause me as much pain. But most of it is we're not moving. And then when we move and we hurt, we're surprised. Mm. I love using the expression, we excel at what we practice. So I had one guy who was shoveling, right? And then he tore his labrum shoveling. If you don't practice shoveling and you sit at a computer all day, you might injure yourself if all of a sudden, after years and years of not doing it, you're going to do something that's so extreme. Mm.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's so interesting how the human body will adapt to whatever conditions we provide it. And it's actually almost like a protective mechanism in that environment. But once you change the environment, like you said, that's where we open ourselves up to be prone to other injuries. Is that the way you see it?
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that, and we'll probably get more into it, I like to just divide movements very simply into forwards, backwards, side to side, and twisting. Because really, if you look at any joint, that's essentially, you could put it into those three categories. But every time I talk about it, I go, but think about twisting. twisting we sometimes use as an injury thing, because we injure ourselves so much with twisting just because we don't do it often. And even most exercises are usually done forwards, backwards, or side to side. It's rare that we actually do a whole lot of twisting with them.
Mm. I don't know if this is accurate, but I remember hearing something like 85% of all like soccer injuries are due to twisting. Does that sound about right?
That sounds about right. Mm. Yeah. So much of knee and ACL stuff is because somebody planted their foot and then they twisted around that planted foot. And then it just didn't hold. They didn't have the strength of the hips. There was just too much torque because somebody else hit them, whatever it may be.
Mm, wow. So I believe it was Dr. James Levine back in 2014 made the claim that sitting is the new smoking or something like that. And it was really sensationalized and it brought to the consciousness to a lot of people of, you know, the harms of sitting. And I don't know if he was paid by Fitbit or not, but that kind of launched the, you know, the step tracking movement. And, you know, for better or worse, I think it helped a lot of people be a lot more aware of that. Do you see sitting as akin to smoking? Is that kind of sensationalized? How do you see prolonged sitting?
It's one that I like to use. It's definitely an attention grabber. But my only worry with it is that when we say sitting is the new smoking, smoking really does impact your lungs. Not that sitting doesn't, because sitting in a poor hunched over posture does affect your airflow. But I think it takes this habit of, well, how in the world do I not sit? Because not smoke, well, you don't really have to smoke. Our society isn't developed around this idea of you having to smoke. But most of us are structured in a place where, well, we have to sit for a good portion of the day, whatever it may be. Even if we think about school, for the first couple of decades, pretty much all kids are going, yep, you're just going to be sitting. Especially if you go to undergrad and grad school, that's just sitting all the time. So I agree with the fact that it is bad for our health, but it may just be bad for our health in different ways than smoking is. As far as premature death risks, yeah, it's that bad.
Gotcha. In what specific ways does sitting transform the body to open itself up to some of those injuries you mentioned? You mentioned back pain, neck pain. How does sitting specifically affect, you know, certain muscle groups or parts of the body to cause those types of pain?
Sure. So with specific to neck and back pain, a portion of that is, I also love getting into this idea of good and bad posture. It's a bit of a misnomer. There isn't really a good or bad posture. We have these postures that we can get into. Our body is a wonderful, complex number of joints that allows us to express movement, and we can get into any of those postures. Being hunched over, rounded shoulders, head forward, like we are when we're on our phones or computers, is not a bad posture. Sitting that way for 12 hours is bad. That's kind of a little bit of a difference, because similarly, if you were to straighten all the way up and bend back and stretch, that feels good in the moment. But if you spent 12 hours that way, that would be bad and painful, and you would get pain in other places. It's just that this is what happens. We tend to round forward most of the time. Mm-hmm. So one is, because our spine is going to be consistently kind of that rounded shape, that almost C shape, that's going to force our neck to come up, because if we just let it be neutral, we would be staring down at the ground the whole time. So immediately you kind of create this pinching in the neck. And then there's this constant pulling at the low back muscles, which are tend to be generally tight for most of us. And so what you're having is the body's trying to adjust for whatever task you're trying to ask it to do. You're sitting in a poor posture for a long period of time and trying to adjust for it with other joints. And as you're doing that day in, day out, month in, year, that's what's going to cause that prolonged stress of sort of the ligaments, as well as the muscles and the tendons of your spine, neck, and kind of low back. Mm. So that's the side of the posture. So just being in that posture, you're stressing those joints. So most of us go, if I straighten up, my back doesn't really hurt. Great, because you're not putting that constant tensile stress on the low back. But brushing that sort of aside, is that's that portion of, we're just spending so much in one posture without enough movement. But what does that really do to us physiologically? And this is almost where we get into, well, how long is good versus how long is bad as far as sitting? We'll start at the really high numbers. So 11 hours or more throughout the day increases your risk of premature death by about 40%. In that study, it was 60% for women. The sad part is that that's not the wow. The wow is it's not reduced with exercise. So they balanced it for people who exercise and didn't. The risk didn't change, which is why a lot of what I try to say is it's not about doing more exercise, guys. It's about sitting less. Mm-hmm. And it's a big kind of problem. So then if you go down a little bit, 8 hours or so, that about doubles your risk of cardiovascular disease. So that's kind of problematic. And then they found that about 6 or more hours, you're a little bit more prone to depression and anxiety. I think that one, there's a lot more to it than that. And mindset is an important part. I think if you're down to 6 hours of sitting per day, you're doing great, especially as a desk worker. That's incredible. Because the averages are kind of all over depending on for countries, but in the US, it's about for office workers, 86% were sitting an average of 13 hours a day. This is not counting sleeping. Ugh. So well over that 11 mark and the others. So you're having all of this impact you in the sense of you're stressing out your posture and all of your muscles and joints by just staying in one position for too long. After about 20 minutes of sitting, we start to have the gene expression for the muscles basically says, hey, we should maybe start breaking down muscles. It doesn't start breaking down muscles, but the gene expression is starting to show itself, which basically that's one of the bigger reasons for why we should get up about every 20 minutes as an ideal. By 30 minutes, you're kind of getting an issue of where the blood flow to the brain is starting to get reduced. So we think about how long usual meetings are at work or anything like that. You're already going to be forcing yourself into some physiological impact by sitting for that whole hour. Now you're extending that to the 6, 8, 11, however many, up to 13 hours that you're sitting. And that's where you're really starting to compound that impact. Now, if you're starting to have low energy as a result of all that, this because you're having reduced blood flow, so that's going to obviously impact your vasculature. Like we said, 8 or more hours doubles cardiovascular disease. You're probably not going to be doing a whole lot of exercise. If you're not doing as much exercise because people feel tired and sluggish after work, maybe you're not doing impact training because that takes a lot more. So now you're further deteriorating bone mineral density, which is going to be a huge issue for you down the road as far as when you get older. That's something we really worry about for risk of fractures and everything like that. You're decreasing it. Since you're not moving, the muscles are tightening up because you're not allowing them to lengthen and they're just stuck in the same positions. So you're not going to have the right mobility, the right flexibility, and all of this continuously hindered by the reduced blood flow. And your nervous system is just getting the input of, I'm sitting in this position, I'm not having a variety of movement, I'm going to excel at what I practice, so I'm going to be really good at just sitting in this position. And so all of that just piles on itself over and over and over.
Wow.
So I know that was a lot.
Dude, that's such a crazy negative cascade. It makes perfect sense. Like, how would that not impact every system in your body? I mean, just the depression, anxiety piece that you mentioned, I think about if you're sitting that long, it just automatically tells you you're probably not sitting outside. You're probably inside, which means even if you're sitting by a window, you're not getting the full spectrum of sunlight. You're not getting fresh air. It's like we said in the intro, like natural environments. Think how much pleasure and joy you derive from being outside in nature and all the things that are happening and the smells and the fresh air and the birds and all this stuff you're missing out on. That's crazy. No wonder people would feel depressed and anxious in that state.
Absolutely. There's a phrase that I liked as I was starting out on this, because so the reason that I kind of got into this portion of it is exactly what you're saying, is that patients would come in and they would say, hey, my neck hurts. And I go, okay, I can do some joint mobilizations for that. I've got some exercises for your posture here. Wonderful. They felt better in, 4 weeks, and they go, they come back a year later and go, it's the same thing. And I go, well, are you doing your exercises? And they're like, well, not really. I'm like, well, have you tried them? And they're like, yeah, it feels better if I do them, but it still hurts. And I'm like, well, I really can't do much more. It's your desk setup. We've talked about your desk setup and how much you're sitting and not taking the breaks. And they say, I feel better when I take these breaks, when I do these things. But the culture is around it to where they go, it's just, it's easier to just sit and not do it. Mm. And that's that kind of mental side of it, is that mindset is difficult to battle with for sure.
That's crazy. Okay, so this is super relevant. I'm so glad you teed up this question perfectly. I am very fortunate. Like today, I was out the door by 5:30. I've met 14,000 steps. I'm walking around my neighborhood. I've already ridden 20 miles. You know, I'm between clients. My clients, I just like train at the park, so I get to hang on the bars and do all kinds of fun stuff. So I'm always outside. I'm always moving, which is great. But during the pandemic, I did have to go buy a laptop to do business. And that laptop is on my kitchen table. It has been since last year, and it is absolutely not the ideal setup for that, you know, the work that I have to do. And I'm fortunate that I don't have a lot of desk work to do. I do editing on the podcast and maybe some accounting and stuff like that. But talk about, not only are people sitting, but they're sitting probably in places at home where they wouldn't have considered, extended sitting environments before. Maybe they're stuck at home, you know, not only working from home, but working in these environments is very different than their setup was at work. How has that affected things from your point of view?
Right. So it's huge. And this actually gets into a couple of points, because a lot of times you've changed your environment. When you go to work, you have a specific environment. The desks are set up in a certain way. You've got external monitors and all these wonderful things. And so now you have people working from home. And some companies were pretty good. I think it was maybe like 25% of companies gave their employees some money to, hey, maybe you should buy yourself a desk or a chair or whatever it is that you might need. And they were able to change their environment at home, but most are not. And most kind of did what you're saying is, oh, I have a laptop. I'm going to sit at a kitchen table. Laptops are, I don't want to call them the enemy, because I have one. I don't really use it, but I have one. they're just not designed for us to work on for a prolonged period of time, because they force you into being completely hunched over. Or if you elevate it all the way up, then the keyboard is way up there and you're doing T-Rex arms, which is going to do all sorts of fun stuff to your wrist and elbow as far as carpal tunnel and then shoulder impingement and all that. So they're not really designed for that. They're just designed for the mobility of, I'm going to work a little bit here and a little bit there. But it's kind of what I said earlier of, it's prolonged posture. So if you do something like that for 20, 30 minutes, maybe even an hour, that's fine. It's more if you're doing it for 10 hours every single day for a year, then you're probably going to see some issues with it. And so also people are sitting in chairs that are maybe not as adjusted. They're sitting in a bar stool and they're completely hunched over, perching on it, and they're just not quite moving enough. The other huge thing is that we no longer commute. So you don't have this ability of, okay, so I'm going to walk out to my car. I'm going to park. I'm going to walk out of the parking lot here. I'm probably going to walk around during lunch because I need to go out and grab something. People are stuck at home. They're not getting the 14,000 steps that you're lucky enough to get. That's awesome. So it's changing it to where we don't have the environment that's adapted for us. Mm. Now, a lot of what I try to do is also that we need to consider is the culture around it. And I kind of mentioned culture before, but I really mean work culture in this case. Does your team, does your company, do they try to help sort of facilitate these kinds of movements? Because it's really difficult. You have a lot of internal motivation. You're riding around, you're hanging. Nobody is yelling at you to tell you to do that. You tell yourself to do it, and you know how great you feel when you do it. So many of us don't have that. We maybe can get it once we start and once we're actually feeling it, but to get people to start, it usually takes something more. And so most people need some sort of a reliant support group or anything like that, which our workplace really isn't. Because if you're the oddball that's standing on a Zoom call, everybody thinks you're weird. And why is that? Why is that weird? That's great if you're standing on a Zoom call. You should. I'm not going to get too much into it. We can talk more about it because I love talking about it. But how much our culture talks about sitting, because we even go, hey, come on in and grab a seat. You know, we're going to get started once you sit down. It's all, let's sit. Don't just stand around, get to work. like, why is the culture so just focused in on sit, and not as much about the movement side of things? So I think that's the biggest ways, is that people are not quite set up at home. They don't have the environment for that kind of computer work, unless they have a set up specific office. And then the cultural support is not there from the workplace. Mm.
Wow. I think something as simple as doing like walking meetings. My favorite manager, we'd have our, you know, weekly meeting. He'd take us outside. We'd get out of the building. We'd go walk around a park, and we could talk about anything that we would have been talking about inside. We did it outside. It was great. I really cherished those times. And I feel like my brain was more active and more alive, and I took more information out of those conversations than I would have being stuck in an office. What other ways can people be creative about mixing in more movement in a day where, like you said earlier, like you have to work. You got to sit at some point. I know standing desks can be helpful. What other ways can people be thinking about adding more movement into something that they really have to do?
Sure. A note on standing desks is I love standing desks. They're great. It all depends on if you actually use them or not. If you're going, I don't want to spend money on a standing desk, but if you're somebody who has a lot of Zoom calls or anything like that, I even have it set up right now where I just put a pile of textbooks and I put my monitor on top of that. So I'm standing during a call or anything like this. That's very easy. That doesn't cost you anything. It's simple for you to put that in. So I'll kind of break this down into things that you can do at work and then things that you can more so do if you're at home. Obviously, if you're remote work and working from home still, fantastic. You can work on both. So at work, some of the easier things is if you're having a meeting, one, you can schedule in a room that's further away from you. So you're going to have to walk all the way across. Another version of this is some people like using the bathroom on a different floor. So you're forced to use the stairs to go to a different floor. You might meet some other people from a different department. This is if you're working kind of a larger company in that sense. In regards to meetings, walk-in meetings, like you said, are fantastic. If you can create a culture of, well, why do we always need to stand, or why do we always need to sit? Maybe we can just stand for the first portion of the meeting. Maybe for 5 minutes, we could all just stand up. Maybe somebody introduces a stretch to the meeting. And this is what's going to start cultivating that culture of, well, it's okay to stretch in the office because we do this in the meetings. So if somebody's stretching at their desk, great, wonderful. By far, the best thing that you could do for your posture is there's not a specific exercise. It's just standing up and moving. That's always going to be the best because you're not just stuck in that one and only posture. So if you can find ways to set a timer, or I'm going to finish off this email and I'm going to just stand up for 30 seconds. The ideal time, by the way, is 2 minutes. But I find that if people aren't started with it, they don't know yet. 30 seconds is long enough because then they get bored. And if you can use, I'm going to go and get a drink of water or something, I'm going to go grab something from the printer as that movement, your body doesn't know the difference. Movement and exercise are not always the same thing. Movement is a lot more broad than just squats and deadlifts and specific exercises. Your body just wants movement in that sense.
Gotcha.
So then if you have stuff at home, one of my favorite things is I love using chores as a way to break up working at home, because that also gets the chores done. So I'm in charge of sweeping the downstairs, and I will do one room at a time where I'll work a little bit, stand up, and I'll go sweep. And that also gets some of that twisting we talked about and gets a nice variety of motions. Being able, this is like the most common one that people love to use, is parking further away when you go to grocery stores. So then you have to take the walk. Now in the pandemic, social distancing, perfect. You get to park further away from other people. So it's a win-win. You can use it in both ways, depending on how you do it.
Yeah, dude, I'm so glad you brought up the parking lot thing. When we were doing a lot of those step challenges, I just decided one day that would be a great way for me to accumulate a few extra steps, like Costco. That's an easy way to get 1,000 steps at least. Mm-hmm. And I started doing it, and it just kind of became a habit. Like, I wasn't fighting for parking spots anymore, and it was enjoyable to walk a little bit further. And again, sunlight and movement and all that stuff. Well, I haven't stopped doing that. And you look at the total time, all of those days that I parked at the far end of the parking lot, how many steps, how many miles, how much more fresh air and vitamin D did that equate to when it's compounded over years and years of doing it? let's start this movement of like, let's fill up the back end of the parking lot, give the front of the parking lot to anyone who just wants to, you know, get on their little jazzy and ride around. Like, I think that's a great idea. Those are all really awesome and practical tips. And I know you said you don't have any like one specific thing for everybody, and you know, everybody can move a little bit differently, but I'm curious to hear, do you have in general some of your favorite either ways to move or exercises or stretches that really could benefit most people, knowing that obviously they can do all kinds of different stuff, but any that you find to be some of your favorites?
Sure. I really like, so in general, a wonderful way is if you have a favorite exercise, one of the things that I like to do sometimes is just getting into a squat and just hanging out in a deep squat. And that's great. I touched on the movement patterns of forward, backwards, side to side, and twisting. So now, can I be in a squat and slightly bend to one side, slightly bend to the other side? Can I do a little bit of a twist? If you're not used to doing squats, don't get into all that right away. Take it easy, take it slow, be gentle, move within your means is what I like to say. But that's just a way that you can take any exercise you like and just see, hey, can I alter it a little bit by maybe doing a little side bend, by maybe adding a little twist, by staggering my stance ever so slightly. So not into a lunge, if we're talking about a squat, but just a little bit of a staggered squat. Life doesn't happen very symmetrically, unfortunately. So we need to be able to practice all those different things. But one that I really like, because it just hits everything that we tend to tighten when we're sitting for too long, is getting into a lunge and effectively almost a hip flexor stretch in that sense, making sure that you're upright, reaching overhead. And so you're in this lunge, reaching overhead, almost like a yoga pose. And then you're going to side bend towards your front leg and then twist in the direction of your back leg. So if your left leg is forward, you're going to side bend to the left, and then you're going to twist slightly to the right. So why in the world am I even saying to do this? One, you're adding the side and the twist to your spine and to your low back, which doesn't tend to see a whole lot of that movement. We tend to go, oh, I need to stretch my back, and we bend forward and touch our toes. So that forward, backwards again. So you're adding those movements there. It's a big stretch for your hip flexor. If you want to add a little glute squeeze where you squeeze your butt cheek, great. That's going to add more of a stretch to your hip flexor. And that's going to be the leg that's going back. You're stretching that hip flexor. Also, the lats and all of those muscles of the pec and everything on that side, because you're reaching overhead, we tend to spend all of our time with our arms down, hands down, typing. So lats are going to tend to get tight. That's going to limit a lot of our ability to externally rotate the shoulder, because lats are going to internally rotate it, which then is going to impact how our rotator cuff goes. And that's in the clinic, you see a lot of stuff with shoulders and rotator cuffs. So reaching overhead, bending to the side, slight twist, and you can get a really good stretch that way. And you're really countering a lot of the stuff that happens when you're sitting, where you're not engaging your glutes, where you're really tightening up your hip flexors and rounding over forward.
Man, just you describing that sounds so amazing. I want to go do that as soon as we're done with this interval. I can already sense how that would feel. Almost like a, like you mentioned, like yoga pose. It sounds like almost like a crescent pose or like a warrior pose, where you're kind of getting down and twisting around and getting all those movements. That sounds wonderful. I love that.
Extra credit for you is because I know you're going to master it in seconds because you're so active. Then try to see how about breathing, because I know you've talked about breathing and making sure like the nasal breathing and breathing into your belly and your diaphragm. And that's a whole other side of that exercise, but go ahead.
That's great. Yeah. Great advice. We love that. We are never tired of talking about breathing and proper breathing. It's awesome. I'm curious for you personally, what are your favorite moves? I know you have a wide variety of things that you like to do. What are some of your favorite moves these days?
So variety is exactly the key. I love a good variety. My general workout split is, because I don't want to have too much structure, but some structure to a degree, is that I usually do kind of a leg day and then push and a pull day, which is usually upper body. So this way I can experiment. If I find a really interesting exercise, great. I'm going to implement it into one of those kind of categories. But leg day could look like squats or like lunges. It could also look like sprints, because that's going to have that same impact. So I have a lot that I like to do around big compound movements in general. Ever since COVID started, I kind of stopped going to the gym. And so I work out at home. I got a kettlebell for my birthday, which has been fantastic. Nice. And there's so much you could do with that. I've had a pair of gymnastics rings because in undergrad, I actually joined a gymnastics troupe. And gymnastics rings, you can do everything upper body pretty much there that you would need to. And they really, what I love about gymnastics rings is they don't let you cheat. If you are weak in a certain position or anything, they let you know. You can't really power through a lot of that stuff. And then I was walking around the neighborhood and somebody was throwing out a little, it wasn't a full-on barbell, but it was this little barbell with some weight. So I've gathered that. And so what I do is a lot of times I take these movements of a squat or a lunge and I go, okay, how can I alter this to add a little bit of instability to it? So maybe a little bit of a side bend. And I usually will always, if it's a new one, I try it without weight first. Because if I load it up and then I try to do like a side bend lunge or something like that, I'm probably going to hurt myself. So please, if you're listening, don't go out there and do a whole lot of that. But so I do that for the majority of my strengthening things. And then I love just general walks. Most days I wake up in the morning and I just walk right out the front door and just to make sure that I'm outside first thing in the morning. We talked about the fresh air, the sun is just so important. And I feel like it's almost meditative. So it gets me thinking about the day, all the things that I might need to do, as opposed to just staring at my phone. The rule is I don't look at my phone for the first hour of the day. So then I only look at it for my alarm. That's about it.
Wow, man, I love that.
Yeah, that's great. And then exploring movement. Yeah, so if there's any kind of like lizard crawls, bear crawls, handstands, because of my gymnastic stuff, that just kind of finds its way in when I go, ooh, I'm bored, I want to throw in a new exercise. Absolutely. That's variety, great. Variety.
That's great. It's so practical using what you have available and what's available in your neighborhood and so simple. Yet you just gain so much from all of that. I really love that. I'm curious about the love to move to love concept. When did you start to formulate that and what were you hoping to achieve with that?
Sure. So I was starting to think of and putting kind of all of this together November of last year. Of where it was really just starting to get to me, this idea of, hey, people are coming back in, they have the same issue. We talk a lot in medicine, and this is all of healthcare, is that preventative medicine is the best form. If we can get to it before any kind of disease or anything starts, even preventing the flu is easier than curing the flu. But we're not implementing things correctly. We're all sitting too much. We're in these environments that aren't good for our physiology. And so I was starting to have this idea of how in the world do I try to help people and do it more preventatively before they even have to come in and see a physical therapist and they get into pain. And I was starting making this concept. And then Christmas, I got COVID and everybody's had a different response. I had some heart pain as a result of it. And wow. Actually my cardiovascular system really went down to where I really tolerated maybe 15 minutes of walking at any given point. And then I was like, I cannot, I have to sit down. One of the reasons I picked physical therapy is because I would be on my feet all the time. So I had to take more time off from the clinic, even after just the quarantine part, because my heart needed to recover. Wow. And that was, it's fun. Maybe I'm crazy this way, but I wasn't scared. I was more going, ooh, I get to be a case study. I'm going to figure out what I can do. And so I was just constantly, every day was training. I actually did this with my eye as well after some of my surgeries. I would ask the surgeons, can I exercise? And they go, no exercising, no lifting weights. I go, okay, well, can I stand up from a chair? They go, yeah. I'm like, all right, I'm going to go stand up from a chair 100 times. That'll work for me. So I've always found these little ways of how to make sure that I got my movement in. But once again, internal motivation, kind of how I said before, it's harder for people to get that. So I felt that people needed the education piece first, because a lot of people, once they've been a little bit more educated about it, they can see the patterns themselves. So setting up your desk, how's that going to look like? So since I had COVID and I had another month off work, I eventually said, you know, I think I just need to go into this all the way. I don't think that going back to the clinic, it's just going to be the same old, and this needs to start now. It's maybe even already too late in the sense of so many people are already struggling and suffering as a result of inactivity. And so I just went in fully and started developing these kind of lectures and just evaluation tools of going, okay, let's talk about your setup. And as much as I like being the authority and want to be the go-to person of, hey, how do I fix my desk? Hey, what's going to be the best exercise if I'm tight in my low back? I also really want to make sure that people know how to do it themselves. So in that sense of, I think it was with on your episode with Alex, so he was saying having a little Alex. And it's that idea of, okay, can I teach you to make sure that you uphold this and so that the company upholds it as well? So the problem kept on happening is I would go to people, to employees, and I would go, hey, here's this great program. We can set up your desk. It's wonderful. And they go, yeah, that's great, but I don't think my employer is going to let me get up every 20 minutes and walk around for 2 minutes as the ideal. That's just, I don't see that happening. And I realized that there needs to be a shift to where we need to make this important for employers, and that finding all the research of productivity, of reduced sick leave, of how much it improves the bottom line is really where the battle is fought, because they're the ones that are going to be facilitating these movement breaks. And this is kind of where I make the difference between encouraging and facilitating. So an employer that encourages is the one that goes, standing is good for you, and we encourage you to stand and take breaks throughout your work. Facilitating is, we know that standing is good for you. We have given you 3 5-minute breaks throughout your morning where we want you to stand and take the time. Okay, that you've given the approval, and you're actually shifting that culture to being accepting of the movement, because you should know that it's going to be good for your bottom line. And that's where the education for the employers comes in, of telling them it improves productivity. It's going to be good if you get your people moving for you overall. And it's a big battle with corporate wellness and all that, because everybody just wants to buy the problem away. So they want to buy a standing desk, buy ping pong tables, but then people don't know how to use them. It's kind of frowned upon maybe by some people if they see someone playing ping pong too much. So you don't have the culture around the movement. And so that's kind of where this whole approach is going and developed into.
Dude, I think you're onto something with that. I totally agree that I guess I hadn't thought about this as much as you have, but the culture and the mindset shifts that need to happen inside a corporation versus just on the individual level. Like, yeah, you can impact somebody on the individual level, but without getting the entire company involved and on board, that's going to be really tough. So I think that's a great place to go and a great place to start. And I so much hope that your company sees all the success it deserves, because it's just so important and so needed. Man, this has been an awesome conversation. I've learned a lot. There's been a lot of really cool practical tips for people. If you had to distill down one simple tip for the listener that they could take away from this conversation, what would that be?
So it was something that we didn't quite touch on as much, and it's rather simple. So the mindset shift, we've been talking about moving and how we need to move more. That's great. Really, the mindset shift should not be about moving more and exercising more. It's about finding those ways to sit less. So do those walking meetings, do those standing meetings, find the way to reduce that time without just doing more and more and more exercise, and finding ways that you can do your work and live your life with just sitting less. That's the biggest takeaway.
Sit less. I love it. Man, awesome. Where can people go to find you and find your work?
So you can go to the website, LTMMTL, that's the first letters of Love to Move, Move to Love portion of that. I'm also on Instagram with _ Love to Move _, and that's where I pretty much post the majority of fun little hints, videos, and just things to encourage you and educate you. And you can definitely find me on LinkedIn if you want to just directly message me. I am always open to chat.
Awesome. We will link to all of that in the show notes. Dr. Stefan Zavalin, thank you so much for everything that you've done and for getting us out of our chairs and getting us sitting less and moving more and really appreciating the amazing and wonderful things that our bodies can do. We're so grateful for you and your work, and we wish you all the best and have the most impact on people because it's so necessary. So thank you so much for everything that you do, and thank you so much for coming onto our show today. It was an absolute honor to have you.
Thank you, and I appreciate you constantly spreading the word.
Absolutely. People like you make it really easy for us to be able to do that. So thank you so much for your work. And this has been another episode of Balanced Body Radio.